Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Al Trost, session number 98-2, and is titled Religion and Politics in Europe. Let's listen in.
I'm Al Trost. I have taught at Valparaiso University for most of my career. I'm in administration now, so not teaching as much, and if sometimes I get carried away here, it's because I really love the classroom, and so this is an opportunity to get back into it in a small kind of way. A few of you were at the session on Monday where I was talking about the role of religion in Northern Ireland, and I have, as I was saying then, kind of a fanatical kind of motivation here to understand what is going on there, why Christian people fight each other, or at least from the outside it looks like Christian communities are fighting with one another. As I mentioned last time, that when you start unraveling things, that's not exactly the case. But one of the directions that I've gone in to try to understand this is by looking at it from a kind of comparative perspective, especially in Europe, because Northern Ireland, at least until Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia erupted about 5 years ago, Northern Ireland was the only place where this seemed to be happening in at least the Christian world. So I especially was interested in two cases that are very similar to Ireland, Northern Ireland, in terms of their demographic makeup. One is the Netherlands, which is also divided between Protestants and Catholics, but there is a third group there that equals the size of either one of those communities together, and that is a very strong kind of secular block around the Dutch Socialist Party, and about 25 or 30% of the people in the Netherlands pretty much have moved away from either the Catholic or the Protestant, in this case a Calvinist confession, and kind of put themselves very clearly in the secular camp. The other case that's similar in demographic makeup, in fact even more complicated than Northern Ireland, is Switzerland, which has, again, Protestants and Catholics, pretty close to equal numbers as in the Netherlands. And that's complicated, of course, by language. At least in Ireland and in the Netherlands, Protestants and Catholics speak the same language. But in Switzerland, the Protestants speak French, and the Catholics, for the most part, speak German. And so there is social scientists call this a reinforcing cleavage in the society. Now, when one looks at those two cases in particular, you find at the beginning of this century especially, a concerted attempt to try to hold down or cool off the conflicts over religion by building in what's now called in Northern Ireland power sharing. So that, for instance, in Switzerland, which is perhaps the best case of this, the easiest to understand, in their cabinet, it's a parliamentary kind of system, in their cabinet, the languages and confessions share the prime ministership and all the other cabinet positions, so that it could be a German-speaking Catholic who's prime minister in 1 year, and then a French-speaking Protestant in another, and an Italian-speaking Catholic in another year, so that the government revolves around the various confessional and linguistic perspectives. The Netherlands works a little bit more informally than that. In the Netherlands, in fact, it often looked like they were going to have more trouble because rather than going with our kind of approach that is integrating people, putting Protestants in contact with Catholics and vice versa. In the Netherlands, throughout most of this century, each confession was allowed to construct its own supporting social system. There's a Dutch word for this. The English translation is a pillar. So Dutch society is seen as having three pillars, a Catholic pillar again, a Calvinist pillar, and a secular pillar. And each one of those communities has their own, had their own radio station. They had their own television network. They had their own school system. So that rather than looking like there was integration, it looked just the opposite. The society was segmented, divided into these pillars. But the same thing was happening in the Netherlands that happened in Switzerland, only it was informal. While the people of the Netherlands operated mainly in their compartment, the elites, the leaders, because Holland is such a small country, talked to one another in the parliamentary dining room in a way that's not happened in Northern Ireland. They have learned to get along. I'm a social scientist, and one of the frustrating things in social science is you never explain things totally. Or if you think you've explained them, you've drifted off into the metaphysical world or into a kind of reductionist argument or something that's very unsatisfying. The usual explanation for this is simply geography, where Ireland has been isolated from Europe and kind of allowed to turn in on itself and seethe and foment. The Netherlands, as you know, is a flat country, easily invaded. The German armies have gone through it twice in this century, and they are so used to having to get along with their neighbors that there is a spirit of compromise that the Dutch have that perhaps the Irish do not have. But if you're, again, kind of trying to engineer all of this and trying to make Ireland a peaceful society, this is pretty depressing stuff. It means that you'd have to kind of tow Ireland and connect it to the rest of Europe, which is, of course, ridiculous. So it's not easy in that sense to answer. And the other thing that's going on, of course, something I mentioned last time, was that in Ireland, the Catholic Church was truly the church of the people. The church that was imposed from the outside by the, again, rulers was the Church of Ireland, an Anglican communion. And so the Catholic Church was affirmed, was appreciated in a way that denomination imposed from the outside could never be. So, I mean, those are the two kind of similar cases, Switzerland and the Netherlands. But as I've, again, and I've been on this for about 20 years, 23 years, I have also moved out, I suppose, to try to understand this into a even wider perspective, first of all, to other Christian nations, especially the European ones and the United States, and then also to world religions and especially Islam, which is somewhat similar in some characteristics to the Christian world. Let me say two things, and I'm going to try not to be so abstract and get finally down to talking about one or two of these countries a little more. But one of the ways to try to understand the difference among world religions is to see them, and again, if you've been attending the Bible class at 9 o'clock, you get a good sense of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is a historical religion. That is, it's a story of beginnings and sometime in the future, perhaps an end. And God is active, intervening in that history. That is a characteristic that's shared with Islam. So people who study comparative religions talk about historical religions and ahistorical religions, the two major world religions that are ahistorical are Buddhism and Hinduism, where essentially all that counts is a kind of individual life cycle. And so a lot of people believe that this makes Christians, in some respects, more inclined to get involved in the political system and steer it in the right directions. And when the world was a more kind of on the surface religious place, they tried to steer political systems in a direction that they thought was God-pleasing or God-anointed. And some of you have been exposed to the writings, for instance, of the Pilgrim Fathers, the Mayflower Compact, for instance, which talks a lot in these terms. You see a kind of messianic purpose to the United States at that time, the New World. So that's something that Christians and Muslims share. And those are the two world religion cultures where you have more religious involvement in politics. Another kind of big thing that you can compare religions on is whether they have a church or not, or a church and a priesthood. And here, we kind of leave the Muslims in a kind of weak position. There is not, in most, in the majority version of Islam, there is not a definitive clergy. There are teachers, there are Islamic law scholars, there are prayer leaders, but nothing comparable to priests or pastors in the Christian church. The one place where, the one world religion that is somewhat similar is Buddhism, where there is something, not exactly the same, but something, again, like a clergy. So that leaves Hinduism as the one that, at least from the characteristics that I've been looking at, the most different. And as a matter of fact, in societies where Hinduism has been allowed to flourish without contact with other religions, you in fact have the least intervention in the political system. The problem that we see today in the world is that because of the partition of India in 1947, you kind of automatically had a Muslim-Hindu kind of conflict built in, not only between India and Pakistan, but then that inflamed Hindu-Muslim relations in India itself. So now the Hindus, in order to keep the Muslims out of government, because they're more inclined to get involved, the Hindus themselves now have formed political parties and been much more active. The same thing is true in Sri Lanka, the little island nation to the south of India. So that's the kind of big picture. I'm not going to talk about that today. Toward the end of the week, I'll come back and talk about Islam as a kind of another a variation of religion and politics. What I wanted to do, though, is talk about Europe. And here, and I've given a handout, I realized that there was not a good Xerox machine available here, and my wife and I struggled with carrying these Xerox copies on the airplane. And when, you know, you try to think about 10 sessions, I thought at most I'd have 20 people a session. That's, you know, hundreds of copies of this stuff. And so it weighted down our luggage quite a bit. When Mark Schwein unloaded, he asked if I had rocks in the luggage. So. But I only got one today, and I've tried to use the paper economically here and put the little tables on each side. There are basically four patterns in Europe for the cohesion, the unity of the religious community. The first pattern is majority, in fact, almost unanimous adherence to one confession. And this is the situation, of course, in Scandinavia, where the Lutheran Church is, and the figures are here. I'm not going to go over all of these, but you can see that, with the exception of Sweden, which has a large secular community these days, if you've been there, that's very obvious. The Lutherans are really dominant. And of course, the other case for this are the Catholic countries. And they are at the bottom of table 2-1 there. Again, you can see that in all of them, Catholicism is adhered to by at least 90% of the population. Another pattern is the one I've been talking about with Northern Ireland and Netherlands and Switzerland, and that is where you have a mixed religious picture. That is almost equal numbers of Catholics and Protestants. And besides the Netherlands and Switzerland, the other major case for that is Germany. Although that's a special case, and I'm going to talk about it in a minute. I might just say that here from the beginning. Germany was not, as some of you know, a nation really until 1870. And so all of these Protestants usually did live in homogeneous, cohesive communities called Lands in German, states. And Catholics lived in homogeneous regions. And in fact, the Protestant community in Germany itself, even to this day, is divided into kind of Lutheran Protestants who dominate in some, again, lands, Calvinist Protestants, and then the union formed by the Prussian monarchy, the Prussian Union Church, which dominates in some other lands. So at least until Germany became a nation, Germany was not like Northern Ireland, not like Switzerland, not like the Netherlands, because you did have a kind of homogeneous community. Now that has changed since 1870, and besides that, you've had all the tumult of wars and the Third Reich and the division between East and West. And finally, the fourth pattern is where you have a, and I haven't even put that down here, but it's a kind of clear secular community. This was Eastern Europe, of course, under communist rule and the Soviet Union. And I'm not going to really talk about that at all today. Now, this kind of variety of patterns, one religion clearly dominates the culture, there is a mix of confessional viewpoints, has resulted in three kinds of kind of religious conflict or polarization. The one that is still most active in Europe, and I should say from the very beginning that compared even to the United States, and certainly compared to Northern Ireland, you could spend 2 weeks in most of the European countries and not realize that religion was much of an influence on politics if you go by what's in the newspaper or on the media. When I'm saying that religion persists as an issue in some of these countries, it's nothing like the intensity of religion influencing the public sphere in the United States or, for instance, Northern Ireland. The one kind is where there has been a strong dominant confession in control, and it has been questioned or challenged by an equally strong, equally organized secular alternative. This is Mediterranean Europe, where you have a strong Catholic influence in the political system, and then over against it, a strong, especially after World War II, communist influence. In France, for instance, the Communist Party was always even stronger than the Catholic Party. In Italy, at least until the last couple of governments, the Christian Democratic government, the party really of Catholics, has been a little bit stronger than the Communist Party. But we're talking about very strong secular to the, in the sense that they even fight for the most part the confessional party. So that's one kind of pattern, and that's again Mediterranean Europe, France, Italy, to an extent, although it's not Roman or Latin Christianity, you have the same thing in Greece, which again I thought we had enough here, so I'm not getting into that either. Another pattern is where you had, and this is especially true of the Protestant countries and also Germany, where you had a strong and dominating Protestant tradition. The Protestant tradition, from the standpoint of some of the people in the society, became too secular. And so religious conflict became dissenting Christians from that dominant church. We're talking mainly about the Lutheran church here. And then the establishment church. This is the case in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, where you have, again, an official state Lutheran church. And then people who believe that the church has made too many compromises with the modern age. And so you have a strong dissenting tradition. Many of those dissenters came here. Many of us are, I'm German, and you know, come from the kind of Saxon pietists who dissented, again, mainly from the Prussian Union in Germany, saw it as, again, making too many compromises, looking too much like the world, and they were intent on coming here and establishing a kind of church community apart. So that's another kind of conflict. And then the third kind is what we were talking about in Northern Ireland again, where the communities pretty much come in conflict. And that is the case in the four countries I was talking about, Northern Ireland, or Northern Ireland is really not a nation, but Northern Ireland, Germany, Netherlands, Switzerland, and then I'll add to that the United Kingdom, which is, and this is the trouble, get in social science, things don't fall neatly into one category or another. The United Kingdom both has the tradition of Catholics and Protestants in conflict, especially in the 19th century. But it also has people dissenting from the established religion. And in fact, that dissent grew quite large in England. But again, many of those people who dissented came to our country, as in fact in the early waves of immigration and settlement. The Pilgrims, Puritans, the Methodists, these were the dissenters from the Church of England, from the Anglican Communion. So, those are the kind of varieties of conflicts. So I've, again, trying to understand why in some places, you know, this results in conflict, especially the intense kind that we have in Northern Ireland. I've tried, especially in the last couple of years, to look at societies where religion seems to be a unifying factor, a consensus forming, consensus building. Factor. And so my main case for this has been Denmark, but I also have done a little bit of work here on Germany. And so I'd like to talk about some of those cases. Let me, before I get into the particular, on the other side, which is much less interesting to you than a political science class, what I've done here is to put down one of the manifestations of religion in Europe, which we don't have in our country. In fact, every time it begins to rear its head, there are all kinds of efforts to put it down, and this is a church-based or Christian political party. And almost all the European countries have this. Certainly the Catholic countries have a Catholic party, usually called a Christian Democratic Party. In France, it's had various names. The longest one was called the Modern Republican Party, but it's been through different names there. These parties are attempts by the church to deal with modernization and industrialization by constructing an alternative to Marxism. And the way they have done this is they have gone back to a kind of social gospel position, trying to take, especially from the Beatitudes, from the New Testament Gospels, trying to take out a kind of program for dealing with the poor, the hungry, and so forth. And that's what the Christian Democratic Movement is. As you probably know, it's governed Italy mostly since World War II. It's been a party to coalitions in the Fourth Republic in France. It has mostly governed Belgium. It has been a major factor in Germany. In fact, rule has been shared between, the secular alternative, the Social Democrats, and the kind of Christian alternative here, the Christian Democratic Party. You'll see that also in Scandinavia there are some Christian parties, and these are the dissenters. They're very small. They typically get 5, 6, 7% of the vote. These are the pietists, the people who object to secular society. I've often thought, being in Denmark a lot, what people from the outlying areas, especially in Jutland, think when they come to Copenhagen and see the kind of obvious secularity there. I don't know, have any of you been to Copenhagen by any chance? Yeah, it's a secularized city, let's say that.
How so?
Well, there is a visible street life. There's quite a visible kind of sex business, red light district, pornographic shops. In many respects, very, very much postmodern. The descent from Christianity also, especially in urban centers in Denmark, is on the one hand very sophisticated, but also very much in a kind of postmodern mode. And again, this has prompted the people who just cannot take this, cannot, live with this change, to try to form themselves into the political party. Obviously, it's not the majority opinion in these countries. And in fact, if you'd look for where most active church people are, they're probably not in the Christian People's Party, for instance. They're usually in the Social Democratic Party, where they have, and this is true both in the Labour Party in Britain and in the Socialist Parties in Scandinavia, because this is an entirely Christian society. The kind of Marxist variety here has been, in a sense, Christianized. So you can feel at home as a Christian here. Probably would be harder in the Italian Communist Party or the French Communist Party. But in Scandinavian Socialist Parties, you're not going to have many qualms of conscience here belonging to a party or being in favor of a party like this. Because, again, if you see the role of the Christian as reaching out into the world in a helping kind of way and in a redeeming kind of way, in a way the socialist parties are doing more of that probably than any of the other parties. Well, let me stop there and see if you have any questions about those patterns. Some of you may know, especially some of the Scandinavian countries better than I do. The kind of religious conflict with the state in Europe has always been with liberal democracy, and so there it's very instructive for us. As I was trying to plan a sequence for these little presentations. I thought I needed to stop in Europe before we come to the United States because one of the major problems we have is what to do with liberal democracy or what liberal democracy does with us. Because one of the things that's implied in liberal democracy is a kind of separation of church and state. Because religion is seen as divisive in the society. It's something to be kind of played down or put into a kind of Sunday morning capsule. And that's one of the reasons why in the United States there's a lot of resistance to a Christian political party. So that's
what I was going to ask you. If you see what has happened in Europe happening in the United States, and obviously you do, what's happened to the Christian church?
Yes, in a way I do. We are, and this is one of the things, the United States is a really peculiar place in terms of the interaction of religion and politics. For one thing, we are an immigrant nation, and really only Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and maybe the old South Africa were like us. So that means people are being drawn from many confessions. We're kind of the ultimate in pluralism here. So that's one thing that's very different here in our country. There are elements in the culture that are also very different. Some of those identified by De Tocqueville, for instance, the propensity to volunteer to take in the neighbor is different in our culture. But there is, and this is one of the big, probably not the kind of thing to talk about here, but there is in the literature that I need and look at for my own study, there is a debate about something called secularization. I mean, you use this often too to describe what you see is going on. And there are very good thinkers here who believe that this is a kind of general trend in the world. And the European countries are leading the way here. And everybody's going to ultimately follow them for one reason or another, even the non-Christian nations, even the places where Islamic fundamentalism, for instance, seems to be thriving now, eventually they will come that way too. And there is enough to support that kind of idea, you know, in terms of what happens, for instance, in Denmark or in Sweden or in Germany or in the Netherlands, to say, yes, that is happening. Lutherans have, I think, and I don't want to be theological here because there are other places to do that, but I think Lutherans need to be a little more skeptical of that, of dividing the world into kind of secular part and a redeemed part, because we are called to be in that secular world, and much of what's happening there is good. I wouldn't want to say that separation of church and state, for instance, is a bad thing to have happen. It certainly has saved our country from a lot of religious conflict. But that's probably getting more theological than I wanted to get here. Any other questions before I get into the case studies?
Does any place else have separation of church and state like we do, or as strongly?
France has tried it in the revolution. Dorothy Bass talked a little bit about that yesterday after what's sometimes called the first French Revolution. The revolutionaries tried to construct a completely secular society. They thought religion had pulled France down, and so they even went so far as to begin the calendar all over again. A new era is dawning, an era without a kind of religious influence. So the inheritance of the Republican revolutions in France is in favor of separation of church and state. But France is an unusual place, and everybody's unusual. See, this is why social scientists never get any place here. But France has got half of their society, which is in this kind of Republican mode, disavows the church. But then they got another uh, very kind of religiously oriented half. And they're so close together that they share government. You know, for a while you'll have a run of socialist governments. We had Mitterrand, you know, who just died a couple years ago, was president of France for two terms. And then, you know, now we got the Gaullists in, who are part of the other community. And so they're very equal. And so when the one gets in, they try to push back the separation of church and state. So one of the most tumultuous political issues in France, very unusual again to see this in a so-called secularized Europe, was the question over state aid to Catholic schools, where the Gaullist government decided to make up for lost time and increase the subsidies to Catholic schools. Well, this brought the Frenchmen on the other side out to the barricades again. It was a kind of reenactment of the Bastille. So, you know, they came out and they battled the police and everything over basically a church-state issue. So it's not ingrained in the Constitution like in our country, and they don't have a Supreme Court that constantly tells them where the dividing line is, so it's fought. And that's, again, nature of this kind of secular versus Christian culture that we see in these Mediterranean countries, including France in that. So, but that's about the only one. All the others have a situation of a state church or established church. Those are they're different, state and established. But basically what happens in those countries is that there is no separation of church and state. There's religion in the schools. In most places, very watered down religion. I mean, it's they're not, as immigrants come in from North Africa and the Middle East, they're not interested in making this divisive, so it becomes a kind of a very general kind of religion. There's government subsidies to the church in some places, Scandinavia, some of the Scandinavian countries, the pastors actually are employees of the church. There's a Ministry of Religious Affairs that you know, oversees the church, although there are bishops. It's finally the state over the church in these places. By the way, this was a principle enunciated at the end of the 30 Years' War. And so Europe, in a way, is very similar from one country to the other in this respect, in that at the Peace of Westphalia, the Treaty of Westphalia, the principle was enunciated that the government determines the religion, the prince determines the religion. So that's why you have so many countries that have homogeneous religious pictures or religious profiles, is that, you know, the king, King Gustav, simply proclaimed Sweden is a Swedish country, and under the terms of the Treaty of Westphalia, that was entirely what he was supposed to do. And the state is sovereign over the church. In these countries, it's state over church. So that's why there's a Ministry of Religious Affairs. That's why the government, in some places, Germany, for instance, collects a tax to support the church.
But yet the people aren't believers.
Well, I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but they're...
Or they don't attend church.
Yeah, church attendance, and this is one of the major indicators of what people perceive as secularization, is the falling church attendance rate. In England, for instance, I think 7% of English people are in church on Sunday morning, in contrast to about 40% in the United States. I mean, there are communities, the more modernized ones, Birmingham, Manchester, so forth, where it's even less than that. It would be even lower if there weren't a lot of Catholics in England, a lot of Irish Catholics who still are operating under mass obligation laws, and so that bumps up, no telling what it would be without the Catholics going to church here. It would be pretty low.
Turkey's constitution is a secular constitution.
Mm-hmm. It
totally separates church and state, although it's a 90% Muslim country.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But when you're there, though, it feels like a very secular country. I mean, there's most of the Muslims seem to be Muslims in custom more than practice.
Yes, well, that's Turkey, you know, wanting where it's positioned, always wanted to be part of Europe. And so Kemal Atatürk, the kind of great modernizer and liberator in Turkey, was determined that religion, again, this kind of French Revolution style here, wasn't going to pull Turkey down. And so you have this strong proclamation here of separation of church and state, although that's being challenged more now.
By the political parties.
By political parties, yes. Yeah. Anything else? Any other questions before I... I want to talk a little bit about Denmark and Germany, if I could. The kind of traditional issues in European countries have been issues involving the educational system. This is the kind of thing that the church has gotten involved in. As the state has tried to homogenize education throughout Sweden, throughout Denmark, throughout Germany, this again came after the unification of Germany, they have tried to increase the kind of secular component in the curriculum, and it decreased the religious part. So this was a major battle in almost every European country, still going on to a certain extent in France. Another issue is the issue of divorce, where again, the church initially took a very strong stand against divorce. It's a battle like the education battle that it ultimately lost in most European countries. Abortion is perhaps the latest one of these issues in the Protestant countries. Again, those people who wanted to stop abortion have lost. In the Catholic countries, the battle is, to a certain extent, still being fought, although there are just a few pockets left anymore for kind of more Orthodox Catholic position, Poland and Ireland. Otherwise, the rest of the countries have a policy that is, in many respects, with regard to abortion, more liberal than we have in the United States. But as the church has lost attendance in especially Denmark, as these other issues represent defeats rather than victories, the church has, in a way, redefined itself. It has gone in much more than it ever did before. For small voluntary associations, some of them on a parish level, most of them not, kind of self-defined interest groups. And the church has also moved from being priestly, that is kind of to support the government, to prop up the government, to more prophetic kind of role, using a kind of religious distinction here. Where it is now saying what's wrong with certain governmental policies. And there are two of them here that are especially important in the Denmark and the Scandinavian countries. One is environmentalism, where the church has become one of the major critics of the government's degradation of the environment. The church aligns itself with usually an agrarian party and with a green party in protesting, let's say, nuclear plants, which are a big feature of Sweden. And the second issue in which the church has gotten very involved is aid to third world countries, where it has been a kind of constant voice in governmental circles against domestic priorities in spending and trying to get the countries to channel more money into the third world. And I guess, you know, although the economy of Denmark is quite small and the economy of Norway is quite small, these countries are exemplary right now in the world in terms of the percentage of the gross national product that is sent or transferred in aid. The UN in the early 1980s recommended that each country give about 0.7% of its gross national product in private aid and 0.7% in public aid. So this 1.5% of the gross national product should be transferred into third world countries. Well, in the Scandinavian countries, and Norway leads the pack close behind, they have managed to about double the UN target. This is not going to make a major impact on poverty or development in the third world because these economies are quite small again. But it represents, I think, and one can't only say this is because of the church, because obviously, you know, this is something they can align themselves with the Greens and socialists with, but it is, I think it gives a kind of, the church is there to provide a kind of rationalization for this, an ideological reason for doing this. And the same thing, the newest issue, and this is a major controversy in European countries, is the treatment of immigrants. I take it most of you have been to someplace in Europe recently, or many of you have, and you know one of the kind of things now when you land at Vienna or Salzburg or Copenhagen or Paris or London is the number of immigrants from third world countries that you see working around the airport and so forth. Well, this has become a major divisive issue in these societies because they were homogenous to start with. We, again, as a pluralist society, perhaps have a little more experience with handling diverse peoples. These countries, the immigrants represent a major challenge. And even though many other aspects of the government and society in European countries may be entirely open to poor people and whatever when it comes to people with radically different cultures and different color skin, there is a very nasty backlash. And to the credit of the church in Denmark, especially here, Germany is also prominent here, they have taken the side of the immigrants who, in most cases, are non-Christian immigrants, Muslim immigrants mainly. So this is another place where the church has kind of changed its complexion and moved from being kind of part of the establishment and now trying to establish itself as a prophetic voice. And one of the things I've been looking at in Denmark is the kind of increase in affiliation with, now you can't use church attendance here because that won't work. It continues to fall, although it doesn't have too far to fall. So there's, you know, it doesn't go down very much from year to year. But the affiliation of young people in Denmark with various groups sponsored by the church that reach out to immigrants. You see a lot of coffee houses, for instance, in Denmark. The big immigrant group is from Sri Lanka, because Denmark didn't have a kind of empire like many of the countries had. I think the Virgin Islands and Greenland and a few places were part of the Danish Empire. But they don't have a kind of natural clientele group. So they take immigrants from countries that are new in sending out immigrants, and so there are a lot of Sri Lankans there. But there are coffee houses sponsored by the church in the Sri Lankan, or a lot of African people are in Copenhagen especially. And these things, my wife and I were there 4 years ago, and I don't think, you know, my wife's idea of a vacation is always mine. It's always kind of combined with a little bit of research and kind of social viewing. But we walked around these coffee houses, and they always seem to be very well staffed, a lot of enthusiasm by the young people. So this is, you were talking earlier about, you know, is the church declining? This is a kind of new definition in terms of Dorothy Bass's conceptualization of this. I mean, this is a center for hospitality that often doesn't exist otherwise in, especially Denmark, and Germany is the other place where this is going on, especially in the Protestant churches in Germany. Let me just say a word about Germany here real quickly, because we only got about 8 minutes left, and again, should let more time for discussion. Germany is a kind of unique setting because they have always had, or have had, again since 1870, something called a church tax, which most people pay in Germany. Most people agree to have a 10% surcharge of their income tax given to the land kirka, to the land church. Actually, there are 16 states in Germany, but the lands we're talking about here are actually lands from the Second Reich, from the unification of Germany after 1870. So there are about 50 of them. A few more. I should have added East Germany. Probably about 58 of them. And so if you, for instance, my family lives in Lower Saxony. My family's roots are in Lower Saxony. And around, especially Osnabrück, the church is a Protestant church, Lutheran Protestant in complexion. And everybody is charged the 10% tax there, and there are a substantial number of Catholics in that land. About 85% of the people who don't belong to the land church in that land pay the tax. Now, you can get out of it. You go before a notary or a magistrate and fill out a form, and then he makes sure it's you. You know, it's not some militant atheist going around, you know, trying to get people off the tax rolls. He asks you if you, in fact, are the person that's signing that. And after that's verified, notarized, you are then exempted from the church tax. The amazing thing in Germany is that even though, in some respects, again, the society is very secular, especially in Protestant areas, you know, very slim church attendance, mainly old people, mainly women, people have continued to pay that tax. And the tax is used, again, for help for the immigrants, help for the homeless, aid the third world countries. And it's something that the Germans have taken on more or less voluntarily. Most Protestants in Germany support the Socialist Party, although this is changing a bit in that the all the Christian Democratic parties that are in countries with Protestant populations, Netherlands, Switzerland, have now become much more ecumenical. They're not tied as closely to the Catholic Church. Well, whether that's enough to redeem, you know, the future of the church, I don't know. I mean, there are times you despair. You know, I try to go to a church when I'm traveling, just again, kind of observe it as a social scientist and see how many people are there and whether they seem to know the liturgy or they're completely lost and, you know, what the pastor is saying, although that's been a problem in Denmark because I know almost no Danish, so. But you can be depressed, you know, on Sunday morning especially. It doesn't look like anything like, you know, Creveport, Missouri, or Deerfield, Illinois, or suburb of Minneapolis. I mean, it's the large church movement is practically non-existent in Germany.
Well, within the churches themselves, you know, individual parish, do they make any attempt to, you know, bring up the attendance and so forth?
There are always a few pastors that take that as their goal, and there are a few well-attended
not just
churches.
Attendance, but I mean, in, you know, general
knowledge. Yeah. No, the evangelization thing is not part of the tradition in most of these countries, though. Because the church doesn't need that, really, to survive. I mean, part of the reason maybe we do it is you have to have so much money coming in on Sunday, you know, to support the church staff and church building. That's not a worry in these countries to start with. And they take it for granted that almost everybody is a church believer. And when there are public opinion polls, when people are asked, do you believe in God? I mean, it's the same as in this country, you know, 85, 90% say, yes, I believe in God. So, you know, there's not a lot pushing the church out like that. Although, I mean, and again, if you look at outreach differently, if you look at it in terms of, again, of these associational groups, you know, running a coffee shop for the homeless or whatever, there is quite a lot of activity there. Are there any other? I covered a lot of geography today and didn't once get up and go to the map. So,
is that With those countries then, are they fertile ground for some of the more evangelistic churches, organizations now growing so rapidly in the United States, or is there no motivation for them to do that? Mm-hmm.
Well, there is, just as in our country, there is in Scandinavian Lutheranism a charismatic movement. This is a place where people looking for more vitality can go. You still have the, especially in the countryside, the kind of pietistic varieties of Lutheranism, and they have much more of a kind of conspicuous religious life than you would find in the cities. So there are places people can go. Evangelical fundamentalism is not real strong in the Scandinavian countries. It's fairly strong in Scotland and Ireland again, but not very strong in the Scandinavian countries, or in Germany for that matter.
People like the Mormons and the Seventh-day Adventists and so forth.
They're around, mm-hmm,
they
but
seem to
not
be everywhere.
Yes, mm-hmm. And many Americans are on Mormon missions in Europe. But that people coming in who can't speak the language are always at some kind of disadvantage. And again, I mean, because these countries are homogenous, if you're challenging the established order, you've got a long way to go. In contrast, again, to our country, where often you have people kind of in transition and pilgrimage and more vulnerable, I think, to those kinds of movements.
How do they view the United States? Because I've met several missionaries lately from Europe that have come to America.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I think that, well, for one thing, there's more payoff here, I think, in terms of what they can do. Irish are the ones who really export a lot of church people to the rest of the world, principally to Latin America, not so much the United States. But you can still find in parishes, especially as the Catholic Church has a crisis in religious vocation recruitment here, there are people coming from Poland and Ireland, where there's an oversupply of clergy to staff the churches there.
I don't know if this is appropriate, but I noticed that we're having a 12-step meeting here at Holden, and my connection, or my feeling for the 12-step, is taking in a lot of people from a broad section of the economy. Religion per se, but at least a faith in a supreme being is a tenet there. And I'm wondering if that's going to have something to do with the resurgence of the religion influence in politics. Don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I really don't either. I guess I don't expect it. I mean, you got kind of this glacier of secularization running, and it's very hard to turn that back in terms of institutions. Again, you hope that people's hearts, individual lives can be changed, but I think the institutions, we've heard a lot of that in some of the other sessions here, about church being irrelevant and that kind of thing, and I think the institutions are probably not going to grow. Christianity or religion, they will take a somewhat different form than we've been used to.
I can see that, but I'm saying that at least the people I've met in 12-step, they at one point in their lives were anti-religion, but now they're finding that they need that as a base.
Yes, and I think that that's a human striving for, again, transcendence, for spiritual connections. Yes?
Let's see. What you said about here is kind of frightening to me. I haven't been over there for a long time. That is, people apparently leaving the church. I'm wondering, is it a good thing in this country that our churches are trending toward secularizing? Perhaps that's not the right word. But will this continue to bring people to our churches?
I don't know that I would use the word secularizing at our church. I think our churches change more. They're more responsive to perceived needs in the people they serve. And that's more difficult, again, where the state's supporting it, where everything is being kind of dictated out of a central cabinet office and that kind of thing.
Well, I think I heard you say that priests or pastors have no desire to go out and get people. They've got no incentive. Whereas here we do.
Yeah. I think that they're spiritually motivated, but again, it's just not part of the culture in those countries to do that kind of thing. I mean, they've always been able, you are in the Scandinavian countries, in the Catholic countries, the church is the official registrar for the population. When you're christened, you become a citizen at the same time. You're officially named and recognized. And the funeral that the church usually also provides is an official recognition that you're gone. And so, I mean, you remain a part of the church. And, I don't find it healthy either. You know, I mean, I'm so used to, you know, here, and I live in Valparaiso, Indiana, which is got maybe 70% of the people in church on Sunday morning. You know, and it's the kind of typical thing is to see families driving off to church. So it bothers me too. But I guess I've tried to look for ways in which, there is a kind of seed still there, resurgence possible for Christian practice and belief.
I live in Tacoma, and one of the strongest churches in the city is the Life Center. And they do a lot of things to attract people to that church. Social activities, games, and everything. And they also incorporate religion into their program. Oh. So yeah. They're stronger than the Lutheran Church by far.
Hasn't Norway recently proposed a discussion about the relationship between church and state?
That's right, yes.
Can you address that briefly?
Well, I think that one of the things that's going on worldwide right now is democratization. I mean, we see this, you know, the demise of military governments and so forth. And there is a kind of, when I started, I was saying, you know, how there is this kind of encounter with liberal democracy. And I think this is all part of that. There's a kind of realization that the church-state relationship has not been the right thing for either the church or the state, and there needs to be kind of rethinking of this. I think it's probably the Norwegians are much more into democracy than the other Scandinavian countries. I mean, the whole culture is more egalitarian, probably because of the isolation. And I think that maybe a lot of democratic things have started there rather than in Denmark, for instance, or Sweden, which have had histories of strong dynastic monarchies. Where in Norway, the nature of the geography has encouraged much more attention, and plus the connection always with France. The Norwegians have had this kind of special relationship through their history with France, and so they've been able to watch more kind of other constitutional models.
So Christianity has in Europe been at a personal or individual level disestablished for a long time.
That's right, yes.
It's not, it no longer has a established place in people's lives.
That's right.
But at the public level, it continues to be established.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as you referred to earlier, you said a sort of glacial secularization is on a glacial flow. Or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems to me that the rethinking of established Christianity will have implications for the church, as we've sort of been talking about.
Yes.
But it will also have implications for the relationship between religion and politics in general.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, I think it'll be.
And Norway sort of could be an indicator of some of that.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any projections about how that conversation might go?
Well, I think again in Norway, there's a lot of room for hoping that it would come out at a place that's somewhat like the American place. where the government is officially kind of neutral with regard to denominations. I think sometimes, and I was going to talk a little bit about this last time, from my own perspective, I think the government in the United States has been unnecessarily neutral with regard to religion in general. And I would kind of hope that they wouldn't get to our kind of fine drawing of the line of separation of religion and politics or church and state that we have. But I think certainly the idea of neutrality with regard to the denominations will help. I think it will help young people to feel better about affiliation with a parish because it's not part of the official of the establishment. I mean, in these countries, there's been such integration between the religious elites and the government elites. Usually, you know, if you look at the bishops, for instance, in the Scandinavian churches, almost all of them have names that you'll see in Parliament. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're part of an elite group for the most part. The Pietist movement has, you know, reached down into the common people, but even to this day, many of the people you see in the kind of establishment are people with very close family connections with government, and I think it will help. Well, we've gone over time, and thank you very much for that.